Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is side one of For the Record program number 692, titled Women in the Klan, subtitled Palin by Comparison, Part 2. This program is being recorded on October 4th of the year 2009. Before we get into the main body of the broadcast, let me remind you, as always, that you should, if you want to gain a full understanding of what's being presented in For the Record, please use the SpitfireList.com website. It's the best website for this kind of information available. Basically, I've got my entire life's work up on that website for download for free, so please use the website. Now, this program, obviously, as indicated by the title, is in a fundamental way an examination of the history of women in the Ku Klux Klan. And also, I think, by way of instructional comparison, I think something of an understanding of the political phenomenon of Sarah Palin's, well, initially vice presidential candidacy and now her sort of independent ascendancy, is something that, I think we can gain some insights on that from studying the history of women in the Klan. A couple of preparatory remarks, and we're going to review some of Sarah Palin's political heritage in a couple of minutes, but I want to stress a couple of points, seemingly perhaps contradictory at the outset of the broadcast. In talking, obviously, about women in the Klan, we're talking about something that does not get a lot of publicity, or certainly it has not been the focal point of a lot of historical research, but yet women, in fact, played a very important role in the 1920s Klan. The Ku Klux Klan was a very powerful force, not just in the South, but throughout much of Protestant Middle America in the early part of the 20th century. And the phenomenon of women in the Klan is significant both in terms of the history of white supremacist and nativist fascist movements. And also, I think it bears some elements of instruction for contemporary feminism as well. I want to stress that the whole issue, as will be made very clear, by the way, in the text of the book that we're going to be relying on for much of the broadcast, a book called, appropriately enough, Women in the Klan by Kathleen Blay. The author stresses, as one might well gather, that in fact, traditionally the Ku Klux Klan had a very sort of patronizing or chauvinist attitude toward women, and that in fact the inclusion of women in the Klan in a large way not only exacerbated some of those contradictions in the Klan outlook, where on the one hand they saw female Klan participation as essential to success, and yet at the same time women were seen as sort of these idealized little homemakers and man pleasers and baby makers and so forth. Women in the Klan, although they endorsed the Klan viewpoint of Protestant white women as sort of a font of social and political purity, at the same time, the female Klan, the women's Klan movements and bodies had a more complex at one level, and also as far as their attitude towards women, obviously a deeper and more sympathetic attitude toward women. They felt in many ways that women's roles in society were certainly more difficult and perhaps superior in certain respects to those of their male colleagues. But in assessing women in the Klan, it's important to understand that I think there are some important elements of commonality with contemporary women's movements and feminist ideology, and that should be presented not by way of attempting to confuse people to a Rush Limbaugh-like view of feminists as, quote, feminazis, unquote, as he dubbed them in the early 90s. But at the same time, I think it's important to understand how any political ideological outlook is, I guess one could say, fraught with peril. It certainly can be bent or corrupted in such a way as to assume a fascist outlook, even when that is not the case at the genesis of that particular political philosophy. And again, in In assessing the role of women in the Klan, there is this fundamental contradiction between the Klan as sort of the ultimate male chauvinist organization, overtly and explicitly patriarchal, and yet at the same time, their view of women as not only a very useful source of political power, but also, again, Protestant white women in particular is sort of a mythical font of virginal purity. And in that regard, I think the role of women in the Klan, and in general, the synthesized Klan view of women, meaning the synthesis of the traditional male patriarchal slash patronizing view, and also the more complex view of the women in the Klan, overall, it produces something of a mystical fascist and nativist viewpoint that has some things in common with the fascist element in the Green Movement, in that there is a sort of mystical or idealized view of society in which, again, Protestant white womanhood becomes not just a symbol of a particular group of people, but becomes something of a mystical embodiment of a national and ethnic, well, really an ideology and a viewpoint that is essentially not only mythical but very destructive when it is taken out of its ideological and mythical context and is applied or attempted to be applied to society as a whole. So if a lot of what I'm about to say sounds like it's fraught with contradictions, it in fact is, and that is one of the stories of women in the Klan. And just as I don't want to be in any way misunderstood as characterizing feminism or women's organizations as fascist in any way, yet at the same time, I think events such as the O.J. Simpson case, in which some elements of the women's movement sort of signed on to a generally venal reactionary milieu that was involved in a huge miscarriage of justice. And I think the Lynch O.J. crowd was about as fascistic a milieu as I've ever seen. And there were some elements of the women's movement that were very much involved with that. And so I think in terms of assessing contemporary feminism, one certainly does not want to see the Klan as being an embodiment of contemporary women's movements. Yet I think that those who are concerned about the integrity of contemporary women's movements and organizations should beware that a fascist construction of women's rights is something that has a very real foundation in recent American political reality. So when one sees, for example, Gloria Steinem's well-documented CIA background, one always wants to keep such possibilities in mind. Now, one of the things that spurred my desire to proceed with this broadcast is the relatively recent phenomenon of Sarah Palin. Of course, Palin is, or was up until recently, governor of Alaska. She was the Republican vice presidential nominee, of course, under John McCain. She also has a very strong political, historical relationship with something called the Alaskan Independence Party, which not only advocates the secession of Alaska from the Union, but which itself has some very strong fascist and white supremacist affiliations, including those to traditional Southern white supremacists. The Alaskan Independence Party is very pro-Confederate and has strong operational links to the neo-Confederate movement, and overtly states that the Confederate cause and the war against the war between the states was a just one. So when viewing Sarah Palin, whose, I guess, political gravitas comes from her sort of small-town American pure way of life persona, I think the bearing in mind the historical and sociological implications of women in the Klan is an important thing to study. But by way of reviewing Sarah Palin, Ms. Small-Town America, and her overtly fascist and white supremacist affiliations through the Alaskan Independence Party, first of all, for the record, 652 goes into that at greater length, but I'm going to review a little bit of that for present purposes. And this should also be viewed against the background of the neo-secessionist movements in this country, including neo-Confederate. There were a couple of articles in Salon.com about Sarah Palin, the Alaskan Independence Party, and its Nazi, fascist, and white supremacist affiliations. The article is called Meet Sarah Palin's Radical Right-Wing Pals. It's by Max Blumenthal and David Niewert in the October 10th, 2008, Salon.com. And a fellow here named Kreisen is a close associate of Sarah Palin and also someone who was deeply involved with the Alaskan Independence Party. And although Palin herself and her supporters have attempted to downplay that particular relationship, her relationship with Mark Kreisen and the Alaskan Independence Party is anything but casual. It's profound, and it is of long standing. From Salon.com, of the Alaskan Independence Party, for which, to an extent, Sarah Palin appears to be something of a political cat's paw, we read, "Yet Kreisen maintains that his party remains committed to full independence from the Union." Quote, "The Alaskan Independence Party has got links to almost every independence-minded movement in the world," unquote, Kreisen exclaimed, again quoting, "and Alaska is not the only place that's about separation. There's at least 30 different states that are talking about some type of separation from the United States. This has meant rubbing shoulders and forging alliances with outright white supremacists and far-right theocrats, particularly those who dominate the proceedings at such gatherings as the North American Secessionist Conventions, which AIP delegates have attended in recent years. The AIP's affiliation with neo-Confederate organizations is motivated as much by ideological affinity as by organizational convenience. Indeed, Kreisen makes no secret of his sympathy for the lost cause." Quote, "Should the Confederate states have been allowed to separate and go their peaceful ways?" Kreisen asked rhetorically. "Yes. The war of northern aggression, or the Civil War, or the war between the states, however you want to refer to it, was not about slavery. It was about states' rights," unquote. Another far-right organization with whom the AIP has long been aligned is Howard Phillips' militia-minded Constitution Party. "The AIP has been listed as the Constitution Party's state affiliate since the late 1990s, and it has endorsed the Constitution Party's presidential candidates Michael Perutka and Chuck Baldwin in the past two elections. The Constitution Party boasts an openly theocratic platform that reads, quote, it is our goal to limit the federal government to its delegated enumerated constitutional functions and to restore American jurisprudence to its original biblical common law foundations," unquote. In its 1990s incarnation as the U.S. Taxpayers Party, it was on the front lines in promoting the militia movement, and a significant portion of its membership comprises former and current militia members. At its 1992 convention, the AIP hosted both Phillips, the U.S. Taxpayers presidential candidate, and militia movement leader Colonel James Beau Greitz, who was campaigning for president under the banner of the far-right Populist Party. According to Kreisen, AIP regulars heavily supported Greitz, but the party deferred to Phillips' presence and issued no official endorsement. So these are the types of political elements for which Sarah Palin has basically been fronting. And indeed, the Republican Party itself is inextricably linked with the historical and political forces of international fascism, the von Bolschwing, von Dahm connection about which I've spoken so often, the presence of National Alliance Associate Bob Whitaker in helping to arrange security clearances and staffing for the Reagan administration, and indeed the Republican ethnic outreach organizations, essentially a Nazi-slash-fascist wing of the Republican Party with roots firmly planted in the fascism of World War II, indicate that certainly Palin's political background and her associations with the AIP are not something that is alien to the Republican Party. Watching, however, Sarah Palin's political emergence is a very interesting thing because she obviously has a certain amount of appeal, and I would not assume that the bulk of the people who find her politically appealing are necessarily overt or explicit white supremacists, but rather, I think the appeal of Sarah Palin to her constituency is one of image. She's a handsome woman and has that small-town persona, and to an extent, I think that the political acceptance that she has gained stems from the same sort of political mysticism to which I alluded earlier. It really is something of a what the Germans refer to as a gestalt. It is something of an impression that one gets from her appearance and her background and her speech that gives you an almost mystical concept of what she really is. And indeed, the duality of women in the Klan and the way, on the one hand, they were viewed as explicitly secondary in importance, and yet the conceptualization of white Protestant women as the sort of this font of spiritual and social purity, I think is something of the same type of political mysticism that has spawned Sarah Palin's acceptance as well. And hence, I think an examination of the history of women in the Klan, particularly in the early 1920s, and the study of the current Sarah Palin political ascendance is, well, I think that's an important comparison. And I think also studying the history of women in the Klan, or at least examining it here, may very well alert us to potential pitfalls that contemporary women's organizations should be taking some care to avoid. Because indeed, it is possible for someone with a pro-feminist political agenda to be seduced by fascist and native and racist arguments. Again, the book from which we're going to be relying for the rest of the broadcast is called Women of the Klan, Racism and Gender in the 1920s, softcover edition by Kathleen M. Blay, B-L-E-E is her name. It's put out by the University of California Press, copyright 1991. And discussing again, some of the philosophical and social discontinuities that women faced when joining the Ku Klux Klan. Now, the discussion we're about to enter into should be seen against the background of the early 20th century Ku Klux Klan. That was a very powerful organization. It was very pro-Protestant Christian, very anti-Catholic, anti-Jewish, anti-immigrant, anti-black, of course. And the Klan had tremendous influence within Protestant Middle America. It portrayed itself as a bastion of moral rectitude. It was, to a considerable extent, especially its women's wing, it was very pro-temperance. So they were very much opposed to alcoholic beverages and the damage that did to the family unit. They were very much in support of prohibition. And the idealization of the family unit, and in particular, the idealization of women's role in the family, again, something of a political mysticism that is being affected here, had a lot to do with the, again, dualistic position of women in the Klan. But again, this is the what we're about to read should be seen against the background of a tremendously influential, far-flung, widespread Ku Klux Klan, which had infiltrated much of, indeed it didn't infiltrate, but actually comprised much of the social/political fabric of Protestant white Middle America in the early part of the last century. Of Women in the Klan, Kathleen Blay writes, "Women's entry into the male bastion of the Klan presented the men who led the Invisible Empire with a number of perplexing problems. An organization based on principles of fraternalism, protection of white womanhood, and defeat of alien forces, principles that it steadfastly proclaimed as masculine, now admitted women. Clearly, financial opportunism and intra-clan conflict, not concern for women's rights, prompted male clan leaders to create a women's clan. Klansmen expected their female counterparts to act as clannish subordinates, a position that some women no doubt found acceptable. But in an age in which women's political rights were expanding, other women did not see their place in the Klan in such a limited fashion. In the mid-1920s, women and men of the Klan often differed over the idea and meaning of Klanswoman," unquote. Klanswomen sought to integrate a women's rights agenda with the Klan's nativist and racist politics. Klansmen were averse, even hostile, to that attempt. Male Klan leaders assumed that the women's order would function as a subsidiary auxiliary of the KKK, while at least some WKKK claverns or chapters sought autonomy from the male Klan. Ironically, even anti-Klan activists seized on the term of Klanswoman, using it to ridicule Klansmen as effeminate and morally degenerate. To describe the complex gender ideas and politics within the second Klan and among its opponents, traditional classifications of political movements are inadequate under the circumstances. History is replete with examples in which issues of gender cut across these political categories of progressive or reactionary, conservative or liberal, right-wing or left-wing. At times, political movements that appear similar have had entirely different gender politics. Distinct political movements have sometimes had a common agenda on women's rights. Gender ideology and gender politics are not infinitely adaptable, however. Other ideological positions and agendas greatly limit the range of gender issues and gender politics that a political movement can accommodate. Further, a stance toward gender issues that finds acceptance in the early stages of a political movement may become problematic. Progressive and left-wing movements, for example, often have difficulty sustaining committed supporters without paying at least some attention to issues of gender equality. Similarly, to support a women's rights agenda, a right-wing movement like the Klan needed to modify its organization or its ideological commitments. This chapter explores how the Second Klan coped with such contradictions over the course of the 1920s. By the way, that the First Klan was the immediate post-American Civil War Ku Klux Klan. The Second Klan, the broad-based political force in the Midwest, was what's being alluded to here. And just as one wants to maintain an awareness of the dualistic nature of women in the Klan, whereas on the one hand they were officially of secondary importance, and yet at the same time Protestant white womanhood was a symbol and indeed a sort of mystical embodiment, philosophical embodiment of white supremacy and familial purity. That contradiction exists within the context of women in the Klan, as I hope I've made clear and as I'm going to illustrate. So too, however, one wants to maintain one wants to be aware of the fact that there were also certain features of women's Klan ideology that embraced some major aspects of the women's movement as a whole in the 1920s, chiefly women's suffrage, the possibility of women being compensated for housework, the view of housework as equal to or more difficult than paid employment. Also, the women's Klan stressed family values in a strange sort of way, which was both feminist and yet at the same time also dovetailed with a traditional Klan view of women as these idealized but basically virginal and creatures of altogether secondary importance. But do note that there are some features of contemporary feminist ideology and traditional feminist politics that were favored by the Klan, and you'll recognize many of them. The Klan, many of them were involved, many women's Klan members were involved with religious activity, and they were advocates of opening up the clergy to female as well as male members, something that is ongoing to this day. And by the way, when I note Klan endorsement of some contemporary women's and feminist political programs, this should not be misunderstood as criticism of those, but rather pointing out not only the appeal that the Klan had for 1920s women, including women activists and suffragettes, it sounds sort of quaint at this point in time, but also the possibilities that progressive politics can be bent, at least in certain instances, to a fascist agenda, is something that one wants to bear in mind. More from Women of the Klan by Kathleen Blay. Although virtually every piece of Klan propaganda from the early 1920s enjoined Klansmen to protect the virtue of white womanhood, the Klan's ambivalence toward actual flesh and blood women was apparent here also. When Klansmen swore to defend American womanhood, they wanted to be sure that the womanhood they guarded was sexually monogamous and premaritally chaste. At every occasion, the KKK reminded women of their obligations, noting, quote, "The purity and moral integrity demanded of woman have proven of priceless value to the race," unquote. According to a prominent Klan minister, chaste women, but apparently not chaste men, were essential to the preservation of marriage, the home, and the government. The Reconstruction-era Klan used symbols of women's purity and chastity to mobilize white men's fears of the sexual powers of black men. The Second Klan sought to protect pure womanhood not only against these alien forces, but against unladylike conduct by women themselves. By romanticizing the idea of home life while pointing to women's untrustworthiness, the KKK strengthened the appeal of the Klan fraternity as a substitute family for Klansmen. The KKK constituted an official family with God the Father and all Klansmen as brothers. Where women belonged in this spiritual household was unclear. The Oath of Allegiance swore members to fraternal clannishness, unquote, which prohibited defaming, defrauding, cheating, or deluding other Klansmen or their families. Moreover, all local KKK claverns functioned to some extent as women's clubs, sponsoring speakers, social hours, group prayers, and a feeling of solidarity in a setting that often excluded women and children. When contending KKK leaders resolved to enlist women in the Invisible Empire at last, their decision threatened the male fraternity of the Klan. Although the decision was pragmatic, not ideological, the reality of female members contradicted the Klan's image of itself as an organization of and for masculine white Protestant men. Often in the Klan press and in their speeches, Klan leaders wrestled with this problem. How could the Klan define a political role for women that was both subordinate and activist? How could it maintain the Klan's male fraternity and masculine image in the face of this feminine onslaught? The decision to create the WKKK as a distinct organization for women was part of the answer. In the WKKK, women could be enlisted in the Klan's efforts without directly confronting men within the organization itself. A national Klan minister lecturer expressed the sentiments of many Klansmen when he demanded separate groups for men and women, with the women's order clearly subordinate. Quote, "It isn't because women can't keep a secret. We know they can. It was Adam, not Eve, who did the talking. We will never admit women because they cannot do some of the work that we have to do." Unquote. Resolving the question of women's place in the Klan also required ideological change. Klansmen argued that white Protestant women functioned best in politics as the helpmates of men. Good Klanswomen, the Fiery Cross proclaimed, were the allies of good men, unquote. The Fellowship Forum argued that unlike men, women were not self-interested and therefore would act for the common good, presumably following the political lead of the 100% American men. Like other KKK leaders, Hiram Evans, a Klan leader, portrayed the WKKK as an adjunct to the real male Klan. Quote, "Our women are aiding us. Let your hearts beat in the women's order also." Unquote. At the same time, the KKK defined women's political role as separate and subordinate to that of men. It supported women's legal and political rights, issues that would increase its female membership significantly. The Fiery Cross reported favorably on the launching of the National Women's Party campaign for women in the U.S. Congress, calling it a search for justice for women. It cheered a movement for women's equal representation in legislative bodies of the Presbyterian Church. The Fellowship Forum applauded the actions of a woman who obtained a passport in her own rather than her husband's name and regularly featured The American Women, a page that mixed reports on women's rights drives with recipes and fashion news. Again, note all of these traditional pro-suffrage and pro-women's viewpoints being expressed here as part of Ku Klux Klan ideology. And again, note this within the fundamentally dualistic attitude of the Klan toward women. Continuing. The KKK's views on white womanhood reflected these conflicting concerns and the tension between image and political reality. The Ku Klux Klan Catechism asked Klansmen, "What is the attitude of the Klan toward women?" To which they were to reply, "The Klan believes in the purity of womanhood and in the fullest measure of freedom compatible with the highest type of womanhood, including the suffrage." Unquote. And we're going to continue with this program in Side 2, but this concludes Side 1 of For the Record Program Number 692, Women in the Klan, subtitled Pale by Comparison, Part 2. This program has been recorded on October 4th of 2009. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.